Welcome to the Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg from the Keystone Research Center. Fellow progressives, believers in the middle class, in the American dream, in democracy of, by, and for the people. I'm sitting in for Rick tonight on this 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech on the date of the March on Washington in 1963. I am an economist. Sorry about that. Don't hold it against me. And the executive director of the aforementioned Keystone Research Center. Let me give you a few websites. The Keystone Research Center itself is www.keystoneresearch.org. We are the working families think tank. We look at the economy from the perspective of the middle class and regular folk. I'll be talking later today about a brand new report we released today, our annual State of Working Pennsylvania, which is always released right before the Labor Day weekend. You can also go to the website of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, www.pennbpc.org. That's where you can find all the information you want on the budget and tax situation in Pennsylvania. And then the last website I'll give you is www.thirdandstate.org. That is our blog. So if you just want to remember one thing, remember Keystone Research Center and Google it, and when you go there, you can find links to the other sites that I mentioned. Now, I don't have with me the voluble Erwin Aronson, the counsel who often hosts with me when I sit in for Rick. I was hoping to have a new co-host, Ellie Mae, my beagle, because my wife is off in Philadelphia taking care of her mom, visiting her mom, and so Ellie is home at my house in Mechanicsburg all by herself, and I asked permission to bring her into the studio, was told no. So, Rick Bloomingdale, if you're out there and want to visit Ellie Mae and, you know, keep her company for a little while I'm on the show, that would be much appreciated by her. In terms of the show tonight, as always, we're going to focus on the economy and on politics and public policies. This is not the first time I find myself thinking as I look at the American economy and at American politics, thinking about the opening lines of Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Certainly you will see later when I talk through the findings our new report on the recent performance of the Pennsylvania economy with our labor economist, Mark Price, you will understand part of what I mean by the worst of times. We've been doing this report now where we look at wages, we look at income trends, we look at poverty, we look at inequality, we look at how many workers have benefits through their job. The full range of economic indicators. And you'd think that after 15, 16 years of mostly bad news each year, I'd be kind of inured to looking at the newest numbers. But I have to tell you that looking at the trends of the last year, the last 24 months, the last 30 months, which is what we focused on, you know, even by the standards we've grown used to in Pennsylvania and the U.S., these latest numbers are shocking in terms of how poorly the economy is performing for regular folks in terms of jobs, in terms of wages. So that's that's part of what I mean by it's the worst of times. But what I mean by it's the best of times as well is that there is a silver lining here, which is that the growing sign of workers ready to say enough, that they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore, and critically, that they're ready to organize for to fix inequality and bring back the middle class. So part of that is the wave of fast food worker strikes that are taking place across the country tomorrow. According to one press report, there are going to be protests in 35 cities. There are also a number of other organizing efforts, whether it's Walmart workers or Macy's workers, or in Pittsburgh, the giant healthcare network, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, otherwise known as UPMC. There's been a sustained effort there to make the case for lifting up the wages of entry-level healthcare workers in UPMC, and because that would not only help those folks, but have a profound impact on the overall wage standards in the region, and really bring back the middle class in a single stroke in a way that it's hard to imagine any other thing in Pittsburgh doing. So we're going to be talking. So there are these different organizing efforts that seem to be gathering steam, and so and again seem to be a lot less diffuse than the protests around Occupy Wall Street of a couple of years ago. These are you know, protests with a very discreet demand. The fast food workers want $15 an hour. UPMC healthcare workers in Pittsburgh want roughly $15 an hour. It's all about turning jobs that don't support a family, that pay a poverty wage, into jobs that do support a family. These are the best of times in the sense that you can begin to see the level of social mobilization that's going to be necessary to reverse the alarming trends in inequality in wages, the disappointing trends in terms of jobs that we'll tell you about later in the show. So we're going to talk about the bad economic news, but we're going to talk about the organizing and the hope that we can turn things around. We're also going to parse President Obama's speech on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's speech at the March on Washington. I was underwhelmed. I'm probably being unfair, and there's a way in retrospect for President Obama to reflect back on his speech or say some other things that are a little less generic and abstract than his speech was. But I'm basically attempted to give the president a D, and a requirement to revise and resubmit. In best case, the speech was an incomplete. We're going to pick apart that speech, and I'm going to suggest what I think he should have said. But right now we've got a caller from Mechanicsburg. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, John. How are you?
Well, not too much worse for the wear, thank you. Glad to be able to hook up with you this evening.
Are you back home now?
Right home, yes.
Good. So you have a question for us.
Well, not so much a question. I can't hardly find you on the radio because we don't have much of that access here.
Okay.
So that sort of put me at a little bit of a problem. But as far as the president's speech about the 50th anniversary,
yep.
I'm sorry to report I wasn't able to listen to it, so I can't form much of an opinion about it.
Well, we'll play some clips later in the show, so that'll give you a little glimpse. John?
Yeah?
Yeah. Now, for those who I don't think, John, you've not called into this show before, right, when Rick is the host?
No, never. I'm a first-time caller.
Okay, so John is a friend of mine who works in the I'm allowed to say where you work, right, John?
Certainly.
Okay, at the local wine and spirits store. And he's always very supportive because he knows what we do at the Keystone Research Center. We know that we spend our time fighting for working families in the middle class, including the good people like John who work at the wine and spirits store. So I really appreciate your friendship, John.
Well, thank you very much. The pleasure's mine indeed, and I certainly appreciate yours. The thing with Working America that bothers me so much is that as a bunch of blue-collar workers, for the most part, seem to take the brunt of being downsized in every capacity we can get, and I hate to say it this way, but I don't know how else to put it, we're kind of our own worst enemy, because we hear so many of our fellow union members on this Labor Day weekend be negative about our unions. And the truth of the matter is, as far as I can see, if it wouldn't be for American labor, as far as unions, American labor would be little more than slave labor.
No, I think you're right, John. I mean, as folks like you and I like to say, there's that famous bumper sticker about unions that brought you the weekend. Unions also brought the middle class to this country after the 1930s when they became major players in manufacturing industries. And you're exactly right, John. The show tonight is going to be all about the role of unions in bringing back the middle class going forward, and the fact that unless we grow unions in a lot of our service sector, which is where most of the jobs are now, as you know, John, unless we take retail like you're part of, unless we take fast food, unless we take restaurants more generally, unless we take healthcare, unless we take childcare, again, there's a whole list of different sectors that can't go to China, that can't go to Mexico, because they have to be where the customers are, and that's where we can grow the next middle class. We can take a bunch of jobs that make $8 an hour now, and with a union that sets wage standards in the whole region, you could lift wages to $15 an hour. You could get the kinds of jobs that you have in the wine and spirits store. You're not going to get rich, but you could support a family. You get a decent health care benefit. You get a decent retirement. So, again, that's really the subject of tonight's show. And my disappointment with President Obama, John, was that he made an elegant speech, as he always does, and he talked in general terms about paying respects to the people who were the grassroots in the civil rights movement, and he talked about the hardship and the violence. Actually, the nonviolent civil rights movement was itself the victim of a lot of violence from the police at times, and some certain southern states, and also from violence from racists in the South. So again, about what the president failed to do that was most critical from my perspective is he didn't recognize the kind of incipient social movement that exists now. The fact that you've got finally growing numbers of workers, whether it's in fast food or whether it's in Walmart or whether it's in again, the healthcare sector in Pittsburgh, and on down the list, you've got this incipient movement of people who've got the courage to risk their job, who've got the courage to go on strike, who are making very concrete demands about, you know, basically, in the case of fast food, double my wages. If this is the only job that the economy is going to generate for me, you gotta pay me enough to support my family. I work hard. I play by the rules. And he missed a golden opportunity to go from general abstractions about the importance of mobilization and patting people on the ground who are willing to put themselves on the line to create a better world, as well as to achieve something concrete for themselves. He missed a golden opportunity to signal in a more direct way workers who are beginning to mobilize across the country are in fact people of courage and are the best hope for the future of this country and for rebuilding the middle class. So that was we're going to break that down more, John, as we go through the show, but that to me was the missed opportunity.
Okay, well, I don't want to take up a lot of your valuable time, but on one last note for me, if the American worker could decide that when we have a problem, we all have a problem, and it's like nobody seems to have a problem. It's everybody else's problem until it comes right to them personally. And right. When it comes right to them personally, then, gee, I got a problem. Who's going to help? Well, guess what? The truth of the matter is, while everybody else was having their fair share of hardship, where were the people that's now having the problem because they did?
Right, right. Yeah, no, we're all in this together, and we do need to relearn some lessons about collective action. Again, in the end, the only way we're going to stop the obscene trend in this country of where basically the top 1% gets, in recent years, essentially all of the increase in income goes to the top 1%. And the only way we're going to stop that is by people coming together and saying, that's not the kind of America we want. That's not the kind of Pennsylvania we want. We still believe in the American dream. We still believe that people who work hard and play by the rules should be able to support their family. Those are the values that I think these workers in fast food and other service sectors, those are the values those folks are fighting for, and again, hopefully they can teach people the lesson you're talking about, John, which is we can't fix what ails this country without acting together and uniting for a better country and state. Thank you for your time, sir.
Well, the pleasure's been mine, and we'll catch up with you sometime later. You take care, and I hope it's a very rewarding night for you.
All right, thanks, John. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're going to take a break here, and then we're going to hear in more detail about the effort of workers at UPMC in Pittsburgh to come together to transform their industry. Stay with us. We want the world.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell.
The standoff between Wisconsin Solidarity Singers and the administration is intensifying. Doug Cunningham reports.
Videos of the police violence posted on YouTube showed police arresting C.J. Terrell, Damon Terrell's brother, for singing in the Capitol without a permit. CJ sat down. Damon took a step or two toward his brother to take pictures. Three or four Wisconsin Capitol police are seen coming toward him. Damon backed up while putting his hands up when police suddenly tackled him, knocking him to the marble floor of the rotunda. Cops put their knee on his neck, handcuffed him, and carried him out. CJ Terrell can also be seen on video, hands cuffed behind him, with at least three cops holding him. He screams in agony as the cops intentionally inflict pain. Through the pain, he told them he had a right to be in the rotunda. In a YouTube post, Solidarity Sing-Along regular Carl Gibson gives his eyewitness account of Wisconsin Capitol cops arresting CJ and Damon Terrell.
I watched several officers walk up to CJ as he was holding a sign that the police were behind him. And they all walked up to him, all four of them, and CJ sat down because he believes that, you know, the citation should be given on the spot and people should be handcuffed. He stood up, and he's looking over there, and I see him walking toward it, and then several officers look at Damon, and then, you know, Damon starts to step away a little bit, and then these four officers, four of them, and Damon's not a big guy, four of them tackle him on the ground, and then immediately a phalanx of cops get in front, and they're trying to block off cameras from taking shots, and they're saying, back off, back off.
Thousands of fast food workers in more than 50 cities are expected to walk off the job Thursday as part of a national strike calling for better wages. The workers are asking restaurant owners for wage increases up to $15 per hour and the right to form a union. The pressure for better wages started in New York City last November and has been snowballing with actions happening across the country. And has since been snowballing with actions happening across the country. In many cases, the workers are taking a risk by walking off the job as they'll lose a day's pay and possibly risk termination. The push for better wages coincides with an effort by congressional Democrats to raise the federal minimum wage to $10 per hour. In this year's State of the Union address, President Barack Obama called for an increase from the current $7.25 per hour to $9 per hour.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg, from the Keystone Research Center. Now we're going to talk in some detail with a couple of guests about one of the exciting organizing efforts that's going on in a service industry, this one in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh. And we're going to talk to Barney Auersler first, who's from Pittsburgh United, which is a community group in Pittsburgh. Barney, good evening.
Good evening, Steve.
Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your organization and then their role in connection to the UPMC organizing effort, as well as giving people a little bit of a flavor of that organizing effort.
Sure. Thank you. Pittsburgh United is a coalition of organizations that focuses on economic development and most directly on publicly subsidized economic development, which is pretty much the way investment happens nowadays. There's always tax subsidies in one form or another, and really tries to make sure that the pressure is put on the political leaders making the deals and the developers getting the money to get quality jobs, to get what we call family-sustaining jobs, and to really see our communities improve with these investments. Promises always made with every development, but seldom if ever fulfilled, since really people making these deals are interested in campaign contributions for the politicians and getting more profit for the corporations involved. So we had a great deal of involvement. We did the staffing of a big struggle between the Hill District in Pittsburgh and the Penguins hockey team when they got a three-quarters of a $1 billion public subsidy to build their new arena. We've been doing similar kinds of struggles since. Coalition is made up of four unions and three environmental groups, 47 churches, synagogues, and mosques. Action United, rebuilding the Acorn low-income work in Pittsburgh. One Pittsburgh, which is an SEIU investment in the fight for a fair economy. We have a number of other groups, the Pittsburgh NAACP, pretty much any group that feels like you got to go to the streets to make your fight, that you can't just make deals behind the scenes. You've got to get out there and really go after the powers that be. So what that kind of brings us to UPMC, which is the 800-pound gorilla of employment, not just in Pittsburgh, not just in our region in southwestern PA, but it's actually the largest employer in the state of Pennsylvania. And 32,000 of their 50,000 workers at their 27, now maybe 28 hospitals that they own are service workers that are making, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, about a median wage of about $12.18 an hour, which, as you know, as a research center leader yourself, is significantly below what would be anything like self-sufficiency, being able to get along without needing government programs. In fact, as Ron Oakes joins me in a little bit, he's going to be talking about his fellow workers who depend upon things like food stamp programs and low-income energy assistance and qualify for a lot of government programs because their wages just are so low they can't make it. And so you know, what's been happening is the workers at UPMC have just gotten tired of this, and they're standing up and fighting to get a union in their workplace. They're tired of begging, as the Rick Smith show always points out, they're tired of begging for pay increases. One of the interesting things was soon after they started talking about union in the workplace, they got a $1 an hour raise for the first time ever.
Right.
But now UPMC has decided that carrots don't make it. They're really out to destroy any effort by workers to stand up for themselves. We can talk a little bit about it in more detail, but my organization last week released a report analyzing what the effect of this low wage strategy that UPMC is quite proud of, that it talks about being a world corporation with $10 billion in revenue, that they are quite proud of their low income strategy. And what we accuse them of is really undercutting the potential of our economy to grow the middle class jobs back that used to be there when we had manufacturing in southwestern PA. That went away, and now we have a meds and eds economy, as it's described in many circles. But President Obama said when he brought the G20 to Pittsburgh a couple years ago, hey, Pittsburgh's come back. It's got jobs that have replaced those old jobs that used to be manufacturing. Now they're the meds and eds. Problem is, people can't support their families on the meds and eds income. So we're really out there trying to call, you know, say that the public, the community is back in those workers' fight, because we see that as the way that we're going to be able to bring back middle-class jobs in southwestern Pennsylvania.
I think I'm going to come back to the white paper you talked about in a little while, Barney, a report called Unhealthy Choices, How UPMC's Low Wages Endanger the Future of Pittsburgh's Middle Class. That's actually on the website for folks who are interested, of Pittsburgh United. But I want to turn first to Ron Oakes, who's with Barney in Pittsburgh and until recently was a transporter at UPMC Presbyterian and Montefiore Hospital. Ron, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Steve? Thanks.
I'm doing great. Tell folks a little bit about your job and experience at UPMC.
My job is to transport patients to their destinations within inside of the hospital. They got to go to X-ray, you know, surgery or something. We transport the patients throughout the hospital by wheelchair, stretchers, beds. You know, that's primarily my job.
And you've been there your tenure,
couple
years, right? So just to share with people what you were paid and at the beginning and maybe at the end of that two-year period.
I was paid, when I started that job, I was paid $9.18, $9.18 an hour.
Okay. And then after 2 years?
After my first year,
okay,
I got a 15-cent raise.
To $9.33, okay.
To $9.33.
Okay. And then after your second year?
Second year, I wound up at 10.60, I think
10,
it was.
10,
that's
10.
Only because of us fighting with, you know, with UPMC.
Right.
They started throwing coins out to everybody.
Okay.
To pacify us. You know, okay, we're going to give you something.
So just for folks in the audience, that 1060, you know, is only about $21,000 a year, even if you worked 2,000 hours a year, full time, you know, full year. And that's, as Barney said earlier, that's well below the wage needed to support a family in the Pittsburgh area. Now, have you been involved in the organizing effort?
From the beginning.
From the beginning. All right. And how? Tell us how that got started.
I mean, enough was enough. I mean, there was a small group, you know, who actually started this.
Right.
And then I started getting involved, started going to the meetings, you know, and getting involved because I see how things are, just out there in transport, but throughout the whole hospital. The understaffing and the way people are being treated. Because my first year there, there was an estimated that about 15 people were either fired or let go alone. And they weren't even organizing. You know, this wasn't even in effect then.
And they were fired and let go. Why?
For unknown reasons.
Okay. So what happened to you? Because you understand you were fired at one point.
Right.
Because of your connection to the union effort.
Right.
Okay. And then, but then you fought, right? And you at one point you got your job back, right?
Right. We put them up under. I got my job back because we had 80 labor violations against them. We won the settlement, got my job back after 7 months.
And this was, when are we now, earlier this year?
Earlier this year. I went back to work on February 25th.
Okay.
I was fired in last July. February 25th, I got my job back.
Okay, so 7 months later. And then how long, and then what happened? After
3 weeks, 3 days, the day that the city made the announcement that they're going after UPNC for their tax status, is the day they fired me again.
Mm-hmm. And did they give you any explanation?
They made up something.
Okay. Well, so both of you, I mean, again, this struggle, when did the organizing effort, Ron, start? How far back? A year or so? Or?
Yeah, it's going on a little over a year and a half. Close to almost 2 years.
Okay. So both of you, and again, I think from the beginning, nobody expected UPMC to be principled about this and to respect workers' rights to unionize. And unfortunately, as the labor violations you just described, Ron, indicate, they've done what a lot of private sector employers do, which is fought up to and beyond the legal line to prevent workers from forming a union. So after this struggle, now maybe a couple of years old, both of you, what's the workers' level of confidence and sense of belief in the possibility of unionization as a way to fix the quality of jobs at UPMC? Barney, do you want to I'm interested in either of you responding on that.
Well, Ryan can certainly speak to the resolve of the workers to continue the fight.
Right. The worker now, since my second fire, it escalated there.
Okay.
Even prior to that, I mean, but it escalated with my second fire because there's about at least five other people that they fired right after me.
Okay.
You know, okay. And one worker was actually fired for wearing a button that has "Bring Ron Back."
Gotcha.
He was fired.
Okay.
You know, there's so much surveillance going on. I mean, they actually surveillance. When I came back to work, I was under surveillance.
Right.
You know, I had people follow me around. I had to turn around. I had to document everything that, you know, that's happening.
Right.
You know, I actually wrote up a manager, you know, during this course of time, you know. And like I said, 3 weeks and 3 days.
So it sounds like
you turn around and you fire me.
So it's
the ultimate question to them was, what took me so long? Because I knew this was what you were wanting to do.
Right. So from your perspective, there's a stronger sense of solidarity among workers and commitment to trying to change things at UPMC. Barney, again, I'm sure you've been watching the fast food protests, emerge across the country. The last news item we had said tomorrow that they're expecting strikes in more than 50 cities. Now, I see in general terms that effort as sort of a little bit overlapping the kinds of things that are going on in UPMC. But so, I mean, what's your perspective in terms of how the general climate around, workers protesting low wages and service jobs, you know, how does that play into the UPMC effort?
Well, it's actually very reinforcing. there's no doubt in people's minds in southwestern Pennsylvania that if you work hard, you deserve to be part of the middle class. That's an accepted thing. Many people are shocked to hear how bad the wages are at UPMC in particular, because everybody figures this corporation that made $1.3 billion in the last 3 years in profit, which of course they never like to use that word, that they would have their workers in such really low wage, stuck in low wage jobs. It's also a little bit more shocking to realize that UPMC has such bad health insurance, for its workers, its service workers, that, they're the largest employer in the state, but they're also the third largest user of medical assistance for their full-time employees, only worse than Walmart and McDonald's. And that does shock people even more, that the biggest provider of health in the state is also treating its workers so badly that they're forced onto medical assistance, which means they've lost all of their assets, they've lost all of their income, and they are simply deeply in debt already, and then they're forced on the government to go to the government for what they can get at that point. What we see is that, you know, the bravery of workers in industries like fast foods and industries like UPMC, the bravery of workers to stand up and fight back and say, look, you know, I might lose my job, I might get fired, but I'm not going to take it anymore. That's inspiring to the rest of the community, because we're all very worried in southwestern PA. We know that what made good jobs and made our economy and our communities thrive through the 40s and 50s and 60s and beyond was that, you know, jobs in the steel industry and various kinds of manufacturing that used to be in southwestern Pennsylvania, they were union jobs. That made the difference. When I worked in the mill, you know, I threw a band of steel around a coiled up thing at the end of a production line, and I made, in the late 70s, I made $16 an hour, and I didn't make it because I was skilled. I made it because I had a union that had fought for years to raise the standard of living of working people. And so we're just inspired by the leadership of these workers in both industries, and the community is responding. We have had many rallies. We've had lots of solidarity actions for example, when workers get fired now, we take it right to their bosses. We, you know, faith leaders, community leaders, activists from other organizations, you know, go right after the bosses in the hospital and say, you don't have this right. We're going to hold you publicly accountable. We have an action planned a week from Saturday on September 7th in Oakland, where UPMC is headquartered, where we're going to take them on. We're going to get 1,000 people in the streets, and we're going to march on their main hospitals. And we're going to join the leadership of the workers like Ron and many others that are so brave to say, you're not standing alone, we're standing with you. So it's just been an inspiration for us.
I want to highlight two things that running through what you two are saying. Partly, Barney, again, the white paper, but also some of the things you've said, unhealthy choices, how UPMC's low wages endanger the future of Pittsburgh's middle class. This campaign seems different in that it's really taking the time to explain to the community, you know, a union's not just good for the particular workers who would become members of the union, the particular workers who would get maybe better wages and benefits, but this campaign is really important and valuable to the community as a whole. I mean, I think for a period of time, unions maybe didn't explain as much as they took for granted the idea that people would think that union strength and community well-being were lined up. And I mean, I think it's really important the way in which you and Ron and the whole organizing effort really are making the case to the community.
Well, it is, yes, it is you know, again, for a long time assumed because there was a culture of union in, and again, I know Southwestern PA pretty well, so I'll keep my comments to there, that everybody understood the reason that our communities were thriving were that people, you know, had good enough jobs to be able to go to the barber shop and to buy things in the community, to be able to send their kids to school and to just really, you know, contribute to the economy, to contribute taxes. And pay, you know, more in taxes because we earn more money. And that supported schools, that supported our communities, services. So that, when it went away, I mean, their right wing in this country, the big corporate money right wing has really painted the unions as the problem. It just shocked me when I was a steel worker in the early 80s and there was just a massive media campaign saying the reason that the steel industry is closing down wasn't because they were investing around the world and not reinvesting in this country, but it was because workers made too much money that the steel industry was disappearing. Just, you know, people know that's not true if you work in the mills, but increasingly as less fewer and fewer people have a union that they belong to, the culture seems to be going away. So now we have to be clear about it. We have to be very clear that when workers make enough money to spend that in their community, that means everything to that community. Right. So, yep.
Well, and again, if UPMC, as the campaign has explained so clearly, if UPMC could lift the overall wage standard, UPMC is big enough to make an impact on the overall wage standard for healthcare and for the broader service sector. And so simply organizing UPMC would improve the quality of a lot of non-UPMC jobs.
Absolutely.
I mean, the other thing that it seems to me that you guys are making great progress on, and so is some of the other, the fast food organizing, some of the other service organizing, is there's been such a feeling that inequality and the decline of the middle class were unavoidable. You know, manufacturing jobs are going away, globalization, technology, that whole wrap. And what feels like you're doing, particularly at UPMC, but even, you know, it's one big employer. So it's like, actually, if you paid 15, 16 bucks an hour instead of, you know, 10 bucks an hour, that makes a profound difference. And so, it seems like important progress has been made in these campaigns, chipping away at the idea that there is no other way, the only economy we can have is one with growing numbers of low-wage jobs and huge amounts of money going to the top. I mean, these campaigns are, I think, making progress. You're making progress in terms of, well, actually, no, we could actually pay people better, and actually the right kind of union could sustain that, you know, for the long term, and the overall economy is better off, the community is stronger. It's not inevitable. And it feels like if we could turn the corner a little bit more in terms of, hey, we can flip a switch. We can just change huge numbers of these jobs that can't go anywhere, turn them from bad to good, you know, and then we're on a path. Then it feels to me that we are closer to really lighting a fuse and, you know, and getting an upsurge, a social movement, and a big increase in union density.
Yes, and I think that we did some polling in a primary in Pittsburgh there was a real race for the mayor nominations, and in Pittsburgh, whoever gets nominated from the Democratic Party is pretty much assured of winning in the fall. And there was quite a bit of polling done to take a look at people's attitudes. And what we found, at least among the voting population, was an overwhelming sense that UPMC needs to be held accountable to the community in terms of paying its fair share in taxes, to support schools and support transit, things they rely upon for their workforce to be educated and to get to and work, to and from work, and for patients to get to and from their services. And to get that institution to get its workers into the middle class, so that they can contribute to the community. So it's, people didn't like UPMC before. They liked the healthcare they get. We're beginning to wonder some about that given their, real complete focus on profitability. They just got rid of, for example, transcriptionists, which are the people who take what the doctors scribble down or mumble into a recording and turn it into the records and the files for each patient to let folks know like what, for example, their medicine ought to be and what strengths and stuff. They had a crew of 130 transcriptionists who would take the doctor and translate the doctor, about half of whom aren't originally from the United States and whose language is a challenge, and keep the record straight. And most, I think the youngest on the job that I heard was something like 12 years. And many of them had 30, 40 years on the job. They just contracted that out, and they're expecting they offered their transcriptionists, they could take a pay cut of one half of their income, and continued on their job. Needless to say, most are looking for anything else that they could do, going from about $15 an hour down to $7 an hour. But why are they doing that? That is a critical function. These were very experienced people. They were folks who were judged by the quality of their work. Another little piece, the contracting company that's moving in these jobs is going to pay by line of transcription, not by the quality of transcription. So guess what? The quality of the records that are kept that the next person seeing you will look upon to determine what to do next to you to help you get better are going to be much poorer quality, many, many more mistakes. UPMC saved very little money for that move, but they really showed they don't care about the quality of health care. So we're very worried about where they're going. It's a scary direction when your primary purpose is to make more money and to build more hospitals. Where they built a hospital, they closed one in a poor community in Pittsburgh, and they built one a quarter mile from a competitor in the eastern suburbs in order to grab more market share, become even more of a monopoly, and therefore, even charge higher prices. So it's a scary motivation behind this largest employer and largest provider of health care, but it's also indicative of where the industry is going. And again, if we don't stand up as a community and challenge that, if workers don't stand up and challenge the quality of their pay and benefits, we're not going to rebuild the middle class.
Ron, I want to thank you for your courage in this fight and your persistence.
Thank you.
If there's anything we can do to again, raise the visibility of your efforts or support you. Is there anything that folks in this audience, I know where most of our audience is not in the Pittsburgh area except the online audience. So is there any, before we let you go, is there anything that you would ask people to do?
I would like to see people September the 7th.
Okay.
In Oakland, 11 o'clock. It's time to make this impact on the UPMC.
Okay.
Yeah, folks should get in their car. We're going to have a family-friendly rally, and we're going to take the march up and take the fight to UPMC.
On September 7th. And is information on that, Barney, available on Pittsburgh United?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yes.
All right.
It's available there, but it's also available at Make It Our UPMC. It's also a website that a coalition of organizations about 31 different leaders of all kinds of organizations are in the leadership of that. And it's called makeitourupmc.org.
Okay.
And there's a lot of information on there about the whole struggle.
So that's probably a Saturday, September 7th.
Yep.
Yep. All right. Ron and Barney, thanks for working late. That's probably a habit for both of you. Have a wonderful rest of the evening. I think you guys will win, and the work you're doing is so important to everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
We'll take another brief break, and then we'll return. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The firefighters, my friend, and the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is
that united we bargain, divided we beg.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits?
Mr. President, do you see a major difference between the two of you on Social Security?
You know, I suspect that on Social Security, we've got a somewhat similar position. Social Security is structurally sound. It's going to have to be tweaked the way it was by Ronald Reagan and Democratic Speaker Tip O'Neill. The basic structure is sound.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I think that was a setup for more critical analysis of President Obama. The speech he gave today on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. Obama made some of the right points about the role of a social movement, that is the civil rights movement, in passing the civil rights law and passing the Voting Rights Act. But, I mean, the thing that seems to be missing is his understanding of the interaction between him and the growing movement for economic justice in America today, that growing movement for economic justice illustrated by the UPMC organizing effort that we just heard about from Ron and Barney. Again, it reminds me of the movie Annie Hall, where there's a scene where Woody Allen is with Annie Hall and steps out of his own body to sit in a chair and watch himself in Annie Hall. So it's sort of disengaged. And you know, when you're talking about Martin Luther King, I mean, yes, lots of the grassroots folks in the civil rights movement were absolutely pivotal to the gains made in the latter part of the 50s and then into the 1960s. But no one would underplay the role of Martin Luther King and the fact that he was, like, mobilizing people. And so, again, he's in a position to fuel the growing workers' movement in America. And again, I find it mystifying that the former organizer doesn't seem to see that. I mean, I'll close with a couple examples, and then in the next segment, we'll actually play some segments from the speech, and you can judge a little bit more for yourself. But I actually remember one of the critical organizing campaigns that I remember was a child care union organizing effort before there was a child care union, really, with any members or any collective bargaining in Philadelphia. And right before a major organizing effort, I think Auditor General at the time, Bobby Casey Jr., actually wrote a letter which complained about some of the aggressive anti-union tactics of an employer, basically had the workers back. And so it wasn't a generic statement about the importance of organizing rights. It was a thumbs-up signal. It was a pat on the back. It was, and I know from the chief organizer in that effort, that was pivotal in their campaign. And they won, I believe, it was like 48-42%. And, so it does take bravery to organize. People get intimidated, if they're not confident that they will necessarily immediately get another job just as good. There's an economic risk. That President Obama's not yet, at least as far as I can tell, he loves unions in the abstract, but in the concrete situation, he's not supporting the organizing. Again, I did a blog this morning before he gave his speech, which sort of outlined what I wanted him to say, because I kind of knew that he wasn't going to say what I wanted him to say. So I wanted to get on record. The title of the blog was, I Have a Dream. That President Obama will say, the president wants you to join a union. Now, that may seem pretty strong, but the fact is, in the 1930s, the last time the United States had to choose between staggering levels of inequality and broadly shared prosperity, organizers rallied workers around the country with the cry, the president wants you to join a union. Now, there is some historical ambiguity about whether that meant Franklin Roosevelt or president of the then CIO, John Lewis. So maybe it was just in part chutzpah on John Lewis's part. But I think it's probably true that FDR was at least winking at that. And whatever the actual history is, again, that's the kind of support workers need. So that if Obama today had been specific about, even if a little bit indirect, about recognizing the fast food worker protests, recognizing the wave of organizing in service industries to lift up the wage floor in parts of the American economy which are responsible for almost all the poverty wage jobs. The bottom quarter of U.S. wages are basically in service jobs that can't go anywhere. If he had, let people know they had a thumbs up from the President of the United States in terms of their standing up to their employers, standing up for a decent living standard, that could have been enormous and helped reinforce the wave that is emerging. We didn't get that. We're going to take a break now at 10 o'clock. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg. Stay with us.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell.
The standoff between Wisconsin Solidarity Singers and the administration is intensifying. Doug Cunningham reports.
Videos of the police violence posted on YouTube showed police arresting C.J. Terrell, Damon Terrell's brother, for singing in the Capitol without a permit. C.J. sat down. Damon took a step or two toward his brother to take pictures. Three or four Wisconsin Capitol police are seen coming toward him. Damon backed up while putting his hands up when police suddenly tackled him, knocking him to the marble floor of the rotunda. Cops put their knee on his neck, handcuffed him, and carried him out. C.J. Terrell can also be seen on video, hands cuffed behind him, with at least three cops holding him. He screams in agony as the cops intentionally inflict pain. Through the pain, he told them he had a right to be in the rotunda. In a YouTube post, Solidarity Sing-Along regular Carl Gibson gives his eyewitness account of Wisconsin Capitol cops arresting C.J. and Damon Terrell.
I watched several officers walk up to C.J. as he was holding a sign that the police behind him. And they all walked up to him, all four of them, and C.J. sat down because he believes that, you know, the citation should be given on the spot and people should be handcuffed and taken downstairs. And then Damon stood up, and he's looking over there, and I see him walking toward it. And then several officers look at Damon, and then, you know, Damon starts to step away a little bit, and then these four officers, four of them, and Damon's not a big guy, four of them tackle him on the ground, and then immediately a phalanx of cops get in front, and they're trying to block off cameras from taking shots, and they say, back off, back off.
Thousands of fast food workers in more than 50 cities are expected to walk off the job Thursday as part of a national strike calling for better wages. The workers are asking restaurant owners for wage increases up to $15 per hour and the right to form a union. The pressure for better wages started in New York City last November and has been snowballing with actions happening across the country. In many cases, the workers are taking a risk by walking off the job as they'll lose a day's pay and possibly risk termination. The push for better wages coincides with an effort by congressional Democrats to raise the federal minimum wage to $10 per hour. In this year's State of the Union address, President Barack Obama called for an increase from the current $7.25 per hour to $9 per hour.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And finally, we don't have unions in South Carolina. I wear heels, and it's not for a fashion statement. It's because we kick, and we kick those unions hard, and they will not step foot in the state of South Carolina.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Thank you, Governor Nikki Haley from South Carolina. One other thing they don't have in South Carolina is any upward mobility. there was this fantastic study that came out about a month ago. I'll talk about it probably towards the end of the show. Over 6 million kids born in 1980 and 1981, and the researchers broke the country into 700 regions and had a big enough sample size that they could say something meaningful about, you know, if you were a kid who whose family was in the bottom fifth when you were a teenager, you know, what was the chance that you could make it into the top fifth, top income fifth by the time you were 30? And I'm sure Nikki Haley would be deeply proud that she was part of a five. Actually, there's three states that have absolutely the least upward mobility of the 50 states. There's two other southern states that are trying to get to the low mobility, win the low mobility sweepstakes. But three states, of which Nikki Haley, South Carolina, is right in the middle, right between North Carolina and Georgia. If you're lucky, there's like a 1 in 25 chance that if you're in the bottom fifth as a teenager, you may get into the top fifth by the time you're 30. And again, you look at the characteristics of those states, and yes, Nikki, they do have very low union density. Yes, Nikki, they do have so-called right-to-work laws. Yes, Nikki, they do have a history of voter suppression. They do have a history of not investing in K-12 education, particularly for lower-income folks. And they have a very small middle class in those places. And so the anti-unionism that she talked about is part and parcel with those other characteristics that guarantee that if you start as a kid near the bottom of the heap, you're virtually certain to still be at the bottom of the heap as an adult. And again, I just am a little mystified in terms of why why you'd want those policies and certainly why you'd want those outcomes. Again, it leaves you wondering, you know, what's their ideal of upward mobility. I think of the ideal as the American dream. But maybe the ideal in terms of upward mobility is the antebellum period, right? Where if you were born a slave, you know, and I don't know what the exact numbers were, but I think that more than 20% of the population in the South in the antebellum period was, you know, African American. So there you've got a system, a nice feudal system, where if you're born in the bottom fifth, your parents are in the bottom fifth, you are guaranteed to be in the bottom fifth. So maybe 4% is too high for Governor Haley. It is, as I say, mystifying. I'm going to go back briefly to President Obama's speech. And I'm going to quote from the beginning part of the speech. I've got some other segments where I will actually play them, but this one we didn't get on audio, but I'll read it to you. It's near the beginning of his speech. It says, this is President Obama speaking, "We rightly and best remember Dr. King's soaring oratory that day, how he gave mighty voice to the quiet hopes of millions. But we would do well to recall that day itself also belonged to those ordinary people whose names never appeared in the history books, never got on TV. And because they kept marching, America changed. Because they marched, the Civil Rights Law was passed. Because they marched, the Voting Rights Law was passed. Because they marched, doors of opportunity and education swung open so their daughters and sons could finally imagine a life for themselves beyond washing somebody else's laundry or shining somebody else's shoes. Because they marched, city councils changed and state legislators changed and Congress changed and, yes, eventually the White House changed. Because they marched, America became more free and more fair, not just for African Americans, but for women and Latinos, Asians and Native Americans, for Catholics, Jews, and Muslims, for gays, for Americans with disabilities. America changed for you and for me." So again, lionizing social movements and the participants in social movements, no problem with that. But it's sort of the first part. "We rightly and best remember Dr. King's soaring oratory that day, how he gave mighty voice to the quiet hopes of millions. But we would do well to recall." And again, what seems to me is what's missing is the interaction. And also, what's missing is the sense of responsibility. He keeps on pushing on to, you know, the people who want economic justice, which, again, is one of our huge challenges today. They got to do it all on their own? No. He can send a signal that he's supportive of what those fast food workers are doing, what those healthcare workers are doing, what those retail workers, including Walmart workers, are doing. Where's that signal? And again, when I said at the beginning that President Obama gets a D or maybe he gets an incomplete, here's the incomplete part, and I know this is ridiculously naive, but it's like, it's never too late for the penny to drop. So, you know, if he could realize that again, it's not good enough to say in general terms that a social movement is a good thing, people standing up for a decent society is a good thing, collective action that creates a fairer America is a good thing. It's not good enough in general terms. You got to send people here and now the courage you are showing on the front lines of the 1% economy, McDonald's workers in New York, and on down the line. We need a more specific endorsement of what those folks are doing. we can argue about how much that'll help, but it sure would help. And failing to connect that dot for people is a huge missed opportunity on this historic occasion, which, again, Martin Luther King, many people know this, but Martin Luther King was absolutely a fighter for unions and economic justice. I mean, when he was assassinated, he was at a rally for AFSCME sanitation workers. in, where was it, Brett? Was it Memphis?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So, anyway, with that, we'll come back with some actual segments from Obama's speech on that 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech in a couple segments, about 10:45. In the next segment, we're going to talk to Keystone Research Center's labor economist, Dr. Mark Price, the angry middle-aged man, formerly the angry young man. Stay with us. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, and we'll talk about the state of working Pennsylvania 2013.
Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Having been raised in a small business family and now running my own small business, I always find it heartwarming to see hardworking, enterprising folks get ahead. So I was really touched when I read that even in these hard times, one extended family with three generations active in their enterprise is hanging in there and doing well. Chrissy, Jim, Alice, Rob, Ann, and Nancy are their names, and with good luck and old-fashioned pluck, they've managed to build a family nest egg that totals right at $103 billion. Yes, six people, 100 plus billion bucks. That means that these six hold more wealth than the entire bottom 40% of American families, a stash of riches greater than the combined wealth of some 49 million of their fellow Americans. How touching is that? The good luck that each of them had is that they were either born into or married into the Walton family, which makes them heirs to the Walmart fortune. That's where old-fashioned pluck comes in, for the world's biggest retailer plucks its profits from the threadbare pockets of low-wage American workers and impoverished sweatshop workers around the world. Four of the Walton heirs rank as the 6th, 9th, 10th, and 11th richest people in our country, possessing a combined net worth of $95 billion. But bear in mind that one's net worth has no relationship to worthiness. These people did nothing to earn their wealth. They just inherited it. And as Walmart plucks more from workers, the heirs grow luckier. In recent years, while the wealth of the typical family plummeted by 39%, the Waltons saw their wealth grow by 22% without having to lift a finger. This is Jim Hightower saying, how odd that the one percenters consider themselves our nation's makers and consider workaday people to be takers. With the Waltons, it's the exact opposite.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you most? The cuts, the tax
hikes. I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
You've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced two previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
No power without.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. That's Ellie Mae the Beagle. Calling in from my house. Hoping that Rick Bloomingdale or Mark Price or some compassionate neighbor will check in on her since she wasn't allowed to co-host with me here tonight. Although I definitely think she would be a big improvement on Irwin. But anyway. Mark, how are you?
I was good until I heard you barking.
That was Ellie Mae the Beagle. Come on. Don't you know my voice? Come on.
I guess I'm happy to be here, Steve.
Do you do animal noises? I do remember now. We had animal noises on a different show when I was hosting once.
I seem to have blocked out that memory.
I do the duck. I actually had a guy on who was supposed to do the elephant sound, but I didn't have the courage to ask him on the air, which was a failure on my part. So if you do an animal noise, feel free to intersperse it between the third and the fifth bullet point of dismal economic news.
I will sure do that.
Okay, so this is the angry middle-aged man about to be interviewed by the angry old man. Yeah. So for our listeners who don't know this, this is Dr. Mark Price, Keystone Research Center labor economist extraordinaire. And at some point this weekend, between the two of us, we had sort of, as Mark was oversharing with the press on our release call today, we had sort of a few fragments of economic analysis. But somehow magically in 3 days, Mark, we transformed it into a tight and rigorous report.
No, actually, yeah, we pulled a rabbit out of our hat, I think.
Out of some part of us. Anyway, so the State of Working Pennsylvania 2013, folks, is on the website of the Keystone Research Center, www.keystoneresearch.org. You can actually also find, our audio press conference. And so Mark will walks the reporters through some highlights of the report there. If you can't get enough of Mark on the Rick Smith Show, you can get another dose there. The State of Working Pennsylvania is this annual report we do before Labor Day, because before Labor Day, is the one time during the year where the American media cares about working people, although, again, I'm optimistic that there's enough protest and mobilization now that who knows, maybe the country will be forced to have a deeper conversation not only about inequality but also about how to fix it. What the report does is look at wages, inequality, income, job growth, all of the main economic indicators, and precisely what we look at varies a little bit each year. So, Mark, what was the focus of this year's report?
Well, the focus of this year's report, we wanted to take a look and see how really employment and opportunity for the typical Pennsylvania worker changed since 2010, and we focused in on that time frame mainly because really it's beginning in 2010 when you have sort of a change in direction in the country, both nationally and in Pennsylvania, a direction towards, as you have, I'm sure, already talked about tonight, austerity economics, the idea that if you shrink the public sector, you will magically lead to robust growth in the private sector, sort of a perverse, bizarre version of trickle-down economics. And so we wanted to sort of evaluate, what happened as a result of the desire to reduce both the federal deficit and to cut state spending here in Pennsylvania, what actually happened.
And to put what Mark just said about austerity economics in slightly more colloquial language. So in 2010, and certainly the beginning, or in 2011 especially, policymakers at the federal level and the state level hit the economic brakes. We've been spending deficit spending enormously, particularly at the federal level. Before that, in 2009 and 2010, particularly through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, our analysis that Mark did of that showed that we did avert a much deeper recession nationally, and then we translated some national estimates for Pennsylvania at one point. But then in 2011, we hit the brakes. So what happened, Mark, in terms of jobs?
Well, as you would expect, if you're hitting the brakes, job growth was actually in that first year before austerity kicked in Pennsylvania. We added around 87,000 jobs in just 12 months. So we had a very good year. Pennsylvania ranked in that very first year before this austerity economics began. As we've talked about on this show before, Pennsylvania total non-farm growth, sort of overall job growth, ranked seventh in the country. Private sector payroll growth ranked 12th. Those are pretty unusually high rankings for Pennsylvania. So, you know, we had a weak recession and we came out very strong. So we should have been, you know, we had a very good lead on the rest of the country. We were doing well. The prospects for the economy bringing down the unemployment rate quickly were pretty good. Unfortunately, in the year following, when austerity economics kicked in, job growth declined in Pennsylvania. It declined in the next year. Basically, this year, job growth in the last 7 months is now around 5,000 jobs in Pennsylvania. So we're on track to add fewer than 11,000 jobs if the pace of job growth through July holds up. So basically, we've created as many jobs in that first year before austerity economics kicked in as have been created in the last 2.5 years in Pennsylvania. The key reason for that sort of startling finding is that the public sector, and this is a combination of federal employment, particularly in the post office, and some state employment, but largely really local government, and that really translates to mostly education workers, teachers, and other other workers in elementary and secondary schools. Total employment in that sector fell by 45,000 jobs, and really just sort of put that in the right perspective. That's something on the order of like 20 to 25 factories closing. And they just didn't happen because of changes in trade patterns or technology. It happened because we chose to do it. And we just went through, you know, one of the deepest recessions since the Great Depression, and we chose to cause an amount of job loss that really is almost a third of the size of job loss experienced in the 2001 recession, sort of a mini recession, if you will, hit the Pennsylvania economy and caused job growth to slow. And, you know, it was obviously a boneheaded policy choice that was made both federally and here in Pennsylvania, and the consequences have been basically that job growth has slowed over time and continues to slow.
And, again, one thing that I would encourage people to get the report, but the story that Mark just told for overall jobs in terms of 2010 being fairly robust, but then 2011 significantly worse, 2012 worse yet, and 2013 to date the worst, you know, grinding almost to a halt in the case of overall jobs. That basic story is actually consistent, is true for private sector jobs. That basic story is actually true for manufacturing jobs. And so there's been, you know, Governor Corbett, as he begins to worry about his messaging going into the gubernatorial campaign, you know, his folks, again, month-to-month numbers, job numbers vary, bounce around, as Mark is always cautioning people not to overinterpret any single month, but they've had some months by random chance that were decent. And so talking about, in essence, the Corbett private sector jobs miracle, and again, it's hogwash. And so folks in the audience who, again, really want to look at the facts, and draw their own conclusions. You know, Mark's graphs about Mark's, I should say, bar chart, just showing the same things that he talked through for overall jobs, for private sector jobs, just shows very systematically how the number of private sector jobs created each year has been shrinking since Governor Corbett came into office. Talk a little bit about wages, because that's another big part of what you looked at.
Sure. Sort of, you know, the background, which almost anybody can guess, but you need an economist to confirm it. When you have high unemployment, that ultimately puts downward pressure on wages. People are desperate for work. They can't get enough work. People are less likely to leave jobs. The queue, the number of people that apply for each job rises. So that puts a natural sort of downward pressure on wages in an economy when unemployment's high. And, of course, unemployment today is up over 7% in Pennsylvania and nationally. And when you look at wage trends in Pennsylvania since 2010, what you see is precisely what you would expect, declining wages. Actually, for the most part across the board, there was a small gain for a relatively for a group at the high end. But basically, wages across the board for all workers declined in Pennsylvania. And they declined the most for the lowest wage workers. Those in particular below the median, sort of the bottom 40%, saw the biggest declines, and which is, again, what you would expect. Those are the folks that face the most severe competition for employment and are the most vulnerable and have the most difficulty holding on to jobs. And so as a result, their wages have fallen faster really in the last 2 years than for most other groups in the economy.
And just to make this concrete for people, I mean, you're bottom half or bottom 40%, you're talking about declines of about 4 or 5%, which if you're earning 10 bucks an hour, which, you know, is one of the wage levels in that bottom 40%, then 4 or 5% is 40 or 50 cents an hour decline in your wages. So, I mean, that's real money, Mark.
Absolutely, right. And it means that, you know, people are struggling to get by, and it also means that the larger economy is in part struggling. I mean, one of the features of the bar charts that you've been directing everyone to pay attention to is that what we saw as the really in that first year of austerity economics, total overall employment growth took a hit as a lot of school teachers were laid off. Private sector job growth was actually relatively strong in that first year. And we think that's largely because, you know, the sort of the effects of the decline in earnings from people, so many people losing their jobs, were a bit delayed, so that you didn't see the fall off in private sector job growth until the next year.
Right, right. Yeah. So again, you got a pretty toxic mix here. You got public sector spending cuts translating into public sector job loss, and then you got private sector job loss and wage loss, which means that the middle class can't drive the economy by buying things. It seems pretty common sense that the economy's sputtering at best.
That's right.
So that's similar kind of analysis nationally put out by the Economic Policy Institute, which wrote a report focusing on a decade of flat wages. They're rightly pointing to the need for whatever, a higher minimum wage or other policies, unionization that would increase wages, not simply because workers deserve better wages, but really as a way of stimulating the private economy. People tend to forget that all of the pushback from conservatives about what a job killer the minimum wage is, what a job killer unions are, you know, again, the big increase in unionization in this country took place in the second half of the 1930s and into the 1940s. We established a minimum wage for the first time in 1938. So, you know, a lot of things, certainly led by World War II and the deficit spending to rearm to initially help the British in World War II, was huge in terms of getting out of the Great Depression. But it's also true that the enactment of union policies and wage policies, pretty much in the depth of the Depression, also lifted up the whole wage structure over a period of five or so years. And so that really did, you know, this is not just a theory about increasing wages actually stimulating the economy. That's exactly what happened, and that helped sustain that middle-class-driven economy for 30-plus years, you know, from the second half of the 1930s. Mark, I think one other thing that you focus on in your report, which connects with some of the conversations we're having about organizing among low-wage service workers, is you did some analysis of the number of so-called poverty wage jobs.
That's right. It was a feature that we added in last year's report, and we added it back this year. And what was different this year is we sort of asked the question, as we did with wages and employment, what were the trends in poverty wage jobs? And you wouldn't be surprised to hear, given the earlier discussion about wage trends with particularly low-wage workers suffering the biggest declines, that there were increases across the board in the numbers of people living and working in what are essentially poverty wage jobs. And I should probably back up and explain what a poverty wage job is. Basically, we asked the question, what would you have to earn if you had a family of four with two kids? What would you have to earn to have an income that places you above the poverty line? In 2012, you would have to earn $11.19 an hour. And so that's the definition of a poverty wage in Pennsylvania. And the numbers of people that slipped into that category increased over time. In particular, white and black women saw big increases in the numbers of them earning poverty wages, and that was because, in particular, it was among white and black women that we saw the biggest declines in earnings for the wage workers. So really there was a pulling apart for women overall, where women at the topper half of the income distribution, sort of higher wage women, actually did relatively well in the last 2 years, but it was low wage women in particular who really took a big hit. So basically, in 2012, roughly 38% of black women worked in jobs that we would define as poverty wage jobs or earn or pay less than $11.19 an hour. 29% of white women, 17% of white men, and of course, today being the anniversary of the March on Washington, 32% of black men in Pennsylvania work in poverty wage jobs. And again, as I said, there were broad increases across these various groups in the numbers of people from 2010 who are working in these sort of low-wage jobs.
Thank you, Mark. Is there anything else you want to add before I let you go?
No, I think I want to sort of just drive home really quickly. You know, folks should take a look at the report. It's very long and chock full of facts and figures. We can't possibly talk about it here without putting you to sleep. But there's some really good stuff in there, some shocking stuff about trends in the economy for various groups, and so people should check it out. And I think the other thing to point out really is that we also look at manufacturing job trends in the report this year, and really one of the more startling things to see in that analysis was that manufacturing job growth really has been essentially flat in Pennsylvania in the last 2 years. And that sort of goes back to what you were saying about, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric today in Pennsylvania about, you know, the business climate's improved in the last 2 years and that really we're headed for good days again. And the reality is when you look at manufacturing employment, we have seen some gains in traditional strengths in steel-related manufacturing in Pennsylvania, but they have been offset almost entirely now by large losses in non-durable manufacturing, things like printing, paper manufacturing, and as a result, we've fallen behind the rest of the country. Manufacturing job growth in the rest of the country is up by over 3%, and it's barely over 0.2% in Pennsylvania since 2010, which is a really shocking number and quite distressing because, as we often talk about at Keystone, we like manufacturing as a sector overall because, unlike a lot of other sectors, healthcare would be a good example. Manufacturing jobs, even at their worst, pay better for even the lowest paid workers than they do than jobs typically in, say, healthcare. So it tends to be an engine for generating middle class jobs, and it's really an engine that hasn't been performing terribly well in the last 2 years. And I think that's it.
Thank you very much, Mark. We will let you go. And again, the website is www.keystoneresearch.org. You have a great rest of the evening, and I'll see you tomorrow morning bright and early at the office.
Thank you. There's nothing greater than you barking.
It's Ellie Mae again. So she's lonely because, otherwise, you know, she thought she was going to be here with me and with Brett. Brett, who's... She doesn't really know Brett, but I'm sure she would like Brett. So I'm going to say a little more about the state of work in Pennsylvania before I take a break, which is we did sort of counter or juxtapose the depressing news that Mark just walked through from the last 2 years, you know, with actually some good news that we reported on with respect to the Pennsylvania economy just a month ago. If you remember my talking about Nikki Haley's South Carolina and the lack of upward mobility, that same study of 6 million plus kids born in 1980 and 1981 and, you know, what was their income in this as teenagers, with their family's income as teenagers, and how did that compare with their income by the time they'd reached 30 in 2010-11, thereabouts. That study, again, broke the country into 700-plus regions. 12 of those regions were in Pennsylvania. And, frankly, I was somewhat surprised by how positive, that findings were for Pennsylvania. All 12 of Pennsylvania's regions had levels of upward mobility that were far in excess of Nikki Haley's South Carolina or Charlotte, North Carolina, or Atlanta, Georgia, or really any of the five-state southern region, there's five. There's a New York Times map which has color-coded how much mobility there is, and kind of red, if I remember, with sort of no mobility. So these are indeed red states, the block of states with no mobility. I mean, there were pockets of no mobility or low mobility, you know, throughout the Midwest, but not actually so much in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania varied from being in the middle in terms of upward mobility. So Philadelphia, about 8% of kids in the bottom fifth in Philadelphia made their way to the top fifth, versus more like 4% in that southern region. But then the rest of Pennsylvania, more than 10% of folks in Pittsburgh from the bottom fifth made their way into the top fifth. In rural St. Mary's, which is, for those of you who don't know, it's part of Pennsylvania that's Elk County is where the town of St. Mary's is, and it's a very strong manufacturing region. As recently as a decade ago, it still had 40% of its jobs in manufacturing. So again, this was good news for Pennsylvania, and this study, in addition to simply generating the numbers on upward mobility, they also took a first shot at explaining differences in upward mobility. So looking at the variables that were associated with upward mobility. And again, I started to go through that a little bit in my discussion of South Carolina, but they're pretty common sense variables that if an area has a lot of middle class jobs, big middle class, then upward mobility is higher. As part of that, if an area doesn't have concentrated poverty, upward mobility is better. So concentrated poverty is bad for upward mobility, no surprise. Quality K through 12 education. An education good enough to give a kid from any background, to get them out of school, to give them decent, basic skills, a chance to get into college, that's good for upward mobility. Education is the classic engine of opportunity. And so there's still a lot of places in this country and certainly big chunks of Pennsylvania during this 15-year period where quality K through 12 education was a key part of upward mobility. And then there were two other variables. One was strong families, measured in part by low divorce rates. Pennsylvania is a state that has lower divorce rates than average. And then another variable was citizen engagement. And so again, when we looked back at this study and sort of scratched our head around why did Pennsylvania do well, it seemed pretty clear that strong families, a reasonably robust middle class, and with some exceptions, such as some of our cities, not a lot of concentrated poverty when you look at the state as a whole. High quality K through 12 education, even though people love to criticize public education in the state, and obviously the cuts of the last couple of years have been devastating, but the fact is that over the long term, overall investment in K through 12 has been sort of at the lower end of the top 10 states per student in Pennsylvania, and the test scores that mean something show Pennsylvania students to do well by and large, it's also true that it matters sort of the period of time they looked at. So if you looked at 1979 to 1996 in Pennsylvania, which was a devastating period because of the manufacturing job loss, you might have got different results, so the period 1996 to 2010-11 was a period where Pennsylvania did do somewhat relatively better than other parts of the country. So that's important. But so again, we contrasted this year's state of work in Pennsylvania. We sort of said we got some last month. We got some good news, pointing people to the summary of the Pennsylvania findings from the Upward Mobility Study. But here in the state of work in Pennsylvania, we got some bad news. And what struck us, one of the reasons we drew that contrast, is because, when you look at the factors that promote upward mobility, and again, I'm going to focus on three here. A robust and middle class and not having concentrated low-income communities, that's one. Quality K through 12 education, that's two, and then citizen engagement, that's three. Let's look at those three things, because again, divorce rates, as far as I know, there haven't been policies that influence those, and those only change over the long term anyway. But so let's look at the first three factors, and it's almost as if a couple years ago, somebody got advanced notice of this study and sort of Pennsylvania is great in terms of upward mobility. And they sort of said, okay, what can I do to make Pennsylvania in the next 15 years more like Nikki Haley's South Carolina? What can I do to kill the Pennsylvania dream dead? Right? Because it's sort of like, okay, strong middle class. Okay, let's slow down the economy. Let's reduce job growth. Let's increase unemployment relative to the U.S. national average. Job one. That's done. Okay, job two, K through 12 education. Okay, let's cut the heck out of it, and let's particularly cut it in the communities, the cities, that most need quality education, that already have the most concentrated poverty. That's excellent. That's also, we'll also kill a bunch of jobs in those schools because some of those people live in those communities. So that'll be more people with low incomes. Excellent. Two. Number three, citizen engagement. What can I do about that? What can I do about that? How can I make our state more like Nikki Haley's South Carolina? I got it. Voter ID, voter suppression. Let's make it harder for low-income and minority people to vote. You know, those people getting creamed in this economy, they're still allowed to vote. What's up with that, right? It's much too strong a voice in public policy. So, voter ID bill. And so, you know, it's just stunning. And so, I mean, again, for us, the state of work in Pennsylvania is mostly around the shrinkage of the middle class and how that's under assault because of the wrong-headed federal and state economic policies of the last 2 years. But if you look across the three areas, K through 12 education, economic policies that impact the middle class, you know, and again, the voter ID bill, which impacts, tries to reduce citizen engagement. It's like it's a policy trivector, you know, designed by the devil. And so, our conclusion is we need to flip a switch. We need to radically increase wages. Those workers agitating for $15 an hour are absolutely on target. That's about the right amount. Forget this $9 an hour minimum wage stuff. You know, forget it. I mean, you can argue about how high the minimum wage is versus what's the balance between broad-based unions that lift wage and benefit standards in the whole area, service industry. What's the balance between that and the minimum wage? How do we get to sort of mostly $15 an hour, entry-level wages? You know, is that with a $12 an hour minimum wage? And then collective bargaining? You know, we could have a debate. But that's the kind of increase that we need to really substantially rebuild the middle class. We need to reverse those cuts in education funding, and we need also actually to reverse cuts in higher education funding. And we don't need voter suppression. We need policies like same-day registration or internet voting. You know, other states have them. So we need, Pennsylvania is very much in the middle of the pack, even before voter ID, in terms of voter turnout. So we need more citizen engagement, and we need to give the people who are getting hammered by the economy in the last couple years, the last decade, over the last third of a century, we need to give them a stronger voice. Now, it doesn't mean we're going to get these things, but in the end, as we point out in the report, policy, these results we get in our economy, this, you know, the 1% economy, these results we get are a result of policies. They're not a result of a state of nature or technology or globalization or markets or things out of our control. They're a result of policy. And so, obviously, this devil's trifecta, flip that switch, and then you'd have a stronger economy, a bigger middle class, and, oh, by the way, you'd get another half generation of robust upward mobility so that in the year 2027, the next time they do one of these studies, that Pennsylvania still looks like Pennsylvania did this time, not like Nikki Haley's South Carolina. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back for 7 or 8 minutes, and then we'll take a break at 11 o'clock. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
As far as my 2008 compensation goes, it was for my work in 2008. I do believe that it was comparable to compensation for people in positions like mine in the industry.
Could you tell us how much money you made in 2008 before you got the bonus?
My base salary, I believe, was $350,000.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. That was Jack Lew, President Obama's Treasury Secretary. 888-520-RICK, 888-520-7425. Give us a call in the next 7 minutes or between 11 and 12. I am finally now going to actually play some of President Obama's speech and give you more chance to judge for yourself. Now, I'm partly operating the technology here, so the chance for failure is, substantial. But here we go. I'm trying to go. Where's that? Oh, did that come out? No. All right. Do we have a technological problem? Did you turn it on? All right, that's a drag. We're having technological problems here. Okay. I could bark while Brett is doing this, so.
Yeah, it should be working. I don't know why.
Okay, so for some reason, try this again.
Justice work equally for all, and the criminal justice system is not simply a pipeline from underfunded schools to overcrowded jails. It requires vigilance. The arc of the moral universe may bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend on its own.
All right, we're going to start that one more time. Are we going to try turning that?
To secure the game. The arc of the moral universe may bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend on its own. To secure the gains this country has made requires constant vigilance, not complacency. Whether by challenging those who erect new barriers to the vote, or ensuring that the scales of justice work equally for all, and the criminal justice system is not simply a pipeline from underfunded schools to overcrowded jails, it requires vigilance.
Okay, the arc of the moral universe may bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend on its own. And then he elaborates on that. And again, that's exactly right. So that's reinforcing again the importance of social movements to creating the pressure that accomplished the gains of the civil rights movement, the gains of the labor movement in the 1930s. But again, for me, it's like, so you got a role in this, buddy. It's not, you know, yes, it's the folks on the ground, but you're president. So, okay. Now I'm going to play a few more segments. These three short segments are all related to kind of economic issues. So let's see if the technology
works. The arc of the moral universe may bend towards justice, but it doesn't bend on its own. Okay. They were there seeking jobs as well as justice. Not just the absence of oppression, but the presence of economic opportunity. For what does it profit a man, Dr. King would ask, to sit at an integrated lunch counter if he can't afford the meal?
All right, so they were seeking jobs as well as justice, not just the absence of oppression, but the presence of economic opportunity. So, again, putting at the core of the civil rights movement and at the core of the challenge for the future, you would assume, the fight for economic justice. Another variation on that theme, and again, let's hope we can get the technology to work this time.
For over a decade, working Americans of all races have seen their wages and income stagnate, even as corporate profits soar, even as the pay of a portion of few explodes. Inequality has steadily risen over the decades. Upward mobility has become harder. In too many communities across this country, in cities and suburbs and rural hamlets, the shadow of poverty casts a pall over our youth, their lives a fortress of substandard schools and diminished prospects, inadequate health care, and perennial violence. And so, as we mark this anniversary, we must remind ourselves that the measure of progress for those who marched 50 years ago was not merely how many blacks could join the ranks of millionaires. It was whether this country would admit all people who are willing to work hard, regardless of race, into the ranks of a middle-class life. The test was not, and never has been, whether the doors of opportunity are cracked a bit wider for a few. It was whether our economic system provides a fair shot for the many, for the black custodian and the white steelworker, the immigrant dishwasher, and the Native American veteran. To win that battle, to answer that call, this remains our great unfinished business.
Yes, this does remain our great unfinished business. And President Obama missed an incredible opportunity to advance the cause of finishing that business today, underscored the problem of wages and income stagnating, of inequality, of erosion of upward mobility, of communities that are struggling, underscores it's our unfinished business, but then fails to recognize, again, the incipient economic justice movement exploding across the country, and therefore fails to reinforce it and makes it a little bit less likely that that movement will take off and achieve quick, substantial progress, which is what we need. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Stay with us.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. The standoff between Wisconsin Solidarity Singers and the administration is intensifying. Doug Cunningham reports.
Videos of the police violence posted on YouTube showed police arresting C.J. Terrell, Damon Terrell's brother, for singing in the Capitol without a permit. C.J. sat down. Damon took a step or two toward his brother to take pictures. Three or four Wisconsin Capitol police are seen coming toward him. Damon backed up while putting his hands up when police suddenly tackled them, knocking him to the marble floor of the rotunda. Cops put their knee on his neck, handcuffed him, and carried him out. C.J. Terrell can also be seen on video, hands cuffed behind him, with at least three cops holding him. He screams in agony as the cops intentionally inflict pain. Through the pain, he told them he had a right to be in the rotunda. In a YouTube post, Solidarity Sing-Along regular Carl Gibson gives his eyewitness account of Wisconsin Capitol cops arresting C.J. and Damon Terrell.
I watched several officers walk up to C.J. as he was holding the sign that the police were behind him. And they all walked up to him, all four of them, and C.J. sat down because he believes that, you know, the citation should be given on the spot and people should be handcuffed and taken downstairs. And then Damon stood up, and he's looking over there, and I see him walking toward it. And then several officers look at Damon. And then, you know, Damon starts to step away a little bit, and then these four officers, four of them, and Damon's not a big guy, four of them tackled him on the ground, and then immediately a phalanx of cops get in front, and they're trying to block off cameras from taking shots, and they're saying, back off, back off.
Thousands of fast food workers in more than 50 cities are expected to walk off the job Thursday as part of a national strike calling for better wages. The workers are asking restaurant owners for wage increases up to $15 per hour and the right to form a union. The pressure for better wages started in New York City last November and has been snowballing with actions happening across the country. And has since been snowballing with actions happening across the country. In many cases, the workers are taking a risk by walking off the job as they'll lose a day's pay and possibly risk termination. The push for better wages coincides with an effort by congressional Democrats to raise the federal minimum wage to $10 per hour. In this year's State of the Union address, President Barack Obama called for an increase from the current $7.25 per hour to $9 per hour.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg from the Keystone Research Center. And now we have the privilege of talking to one of the fast food workers who represents a beacon of hope for this country in the fight for economic justice. Zita, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Now, you're talking to us from Atlanta?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Where do you work?
I work at Arby's inside the CNN building.
Okay. And you've been working at Arby's for how long?
3 years.
Okay. And what's your hourly wage?
It's $7.50, and it's been $7.50 from day one until now.
My God. Okay. What's going on tomorrow that you'll be involved in?
Well, there's going to be, a strike, basically trying to promote this wage going up for the workers of fast food restaurants across America and things like that. And I guess we're going to be out promoting that and trying to get people to, you know, enlist and try to build a union or something for the workers of fast food restaurants. because there's really not a lot of hope for it. There's no privilege. There's no benefits, no nothing. There's just a pay and a lot of confusion and frustration with the pay and working. There's a lot of complaints on jobs and everything, but a lot of people are afraid to speak up for the simple fact of losing their job and everything. But sometimes speaking up is the best thing. You never know what it could do for you.
And how did you get involved in this effort? Have you been involved for a while or?
Well, I think I heard something about this like a couple years back, but like a good 8 months ago, I heard about it and I signed a petition. And then like a good 2 weeks ago, I met a group. And when they talked to me, I already understood the plight and I signed on to be, I guess, a spokesperson in a way for them.
That's very courageous of you. I mean, it feels like to step forward like that and be willing to be a leader. Doesn't that takes a lot of courage, doesn't it?
It does. But you know, I'm an outspoken person, and I know the difference between right and wrong, and I'm not afraid to speak up on things in life. So you know, this is something big because there are a lot of people, and I guess the assumption is there's a lot of teenagers that work in fast food. And that it's not like that. There's a lot of adults, like 24 and up, single women with kids, men, you know what I'm saying, that's coming out of prison or something, or trying to do better with themselves, and they have to start from the bottom. And a lot of times it's restaurants where you have to start from.
And do you know what you hope will come out of this, or is it a little too early to tell on that?
It's a little too early for me, you know what I'm saying, but my hope for it is an outcome, something positive that can help uplift people beyond the job, even in their home, in their communities. It will take away a lot of things and add a lot of things that will be positive, overshadow negative that's always showing in communities across America.
Well, I just want to tell you, you folks are going to get a lot of people saying things about, oh, we can't raise the wages, and that's going to kill a lot of jobs and, you know, put people out of business. And, you know, I have this fancy degree, and I'm called an economist. And I'm telling you, you keep fighting for $15 an hour because absolutely, the fast food industry can pay that. It might end up being a little different. They might use a bit more technology, you know, but it'd be a whole lot better. So, you know, there are a lot of people in the country, growing number of people in the country, who are behind folks like you. And in a sense, you know, we've been talking a little bit today about the fact that it's the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech in 1963 in the middle of the civil rights movement. And, you know, the work you're doing is today's civil rights movement because, you know, this economic justice is something this country hasn't had for the last decade or longer. And so I really appreciate, Zita, the fact that you and your coworkers are willing to step forward like this.
Thank you.
Yeah, what can we do? You know, we got an audience here in Pennsylvania. I'm embarrassed to say that, well, as far as I know, there won't be strikes in any of the Pennsylvania cities tomorrow. Some of that's because there's some other terrific organizing going on in healthcare, and so there's kind of a limited number of balls that people can juggle at the same time. But what can people who are listening to our show tonight, what can we do to have your back?
Stand behind us in our cause and stand behind us in our fight for our cause. You know what I'm saying? It could be more than just the fast food workers in this. It could be more people, their family, you know, people in different levels of jobs and stuff, and different people in politics and religious groups. Stand behind it. You know what I'm saying? Not just the fast food workers themselves. But everybody else should be involved in this and just stand behind and support And once the numbers grow and the support, you know what I'm saying, like something should happen.
No. Well, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, again, when I think of it, back in the 1930s, you know, people get used to the fact that, okay, manufacturing in the U.S., at least in the good old days, the 50s, 60s, 70s, you had unions, you had middle-class jobs. But that all started in a few places. Like, there was a General Motors plant in Flint, Michigan in 1937 where workers sat down and said, we're not taking it anymore. And they showed people how you can take a manufacturing plant and a manufacturing company with crappy jobs. You can create a union. You can lift those jobs up. They're part of the middle class. And then the economy got stronger than ever. So, again, if folks like you can form a union of all of the fast food workers in Atlanta and you can lift those wages up from $7.35 or something like that, you said?
It's $7.50.
All right, $7.50. All right, if you can lift those wages, double them to $15 an hour, then you're going to be, and again, then you got a union and you can bargain over that from that point forward, $16 next year, $17 the year after that, benefits, retirement. If you show people how to do it, then those Walmart workers or those supermarket workers or those janitorial workers or those healthcare workers, right? I mean, it's all a lot of the jobs that don't pay well now, like your job, they can't go anywhere. They can't go to Mexico. They can't go to China, right? Because their customers are right where you are in Atlanta. So if workers can come together in each service industry that has to be right where the customers are, then actually we don't have to accept an economy with crap jobs, poverty wage jobs, jobs that pay after 3 years, you're $7.50 an hour. So you folks are on absolutely the right track. There is an answer. It's totally practical, and all power to you. All right?
I hear you.
I'm talking too much, but I'm not.
Oh, no. You got me tuned in. I'm really listening to what you're saying. It all makes sense.
There's I don't know whether this will make sense or not, but there was a conservative British Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, and she was like Britain's Ronald Reagan, so very conservative and pretty anti-union, anti-worker. And one of the things she used to talk about was that progressives had what she called the Tina problem. There is no alternative. And again, that's what conservatives and so-called, you know, free marketeers like to throw at us. There is no alternative. We got a global economy, there's technology, there's markets, it can't be any way. The only thing that's possible is all the money going to the rich people and the middle class disappears and lots of people have $7.50 an hour jobs. And that's a load of nonsense, complete and utter nonsense. There is a different way. We can totally have an economy that has the middle class back. We lift up wages. Companies can still make money. They can just make money paying workers decently. The economy actually would become more productive because when you spend your time squeezing workers and people keep leaving, you know, and new workers have to learn their job because it's such a crappy job, that's not productive. You can't get high service because people keep leaving. So you're on exactly the right track. Stay the course, and I'll have a special eye out for Atlanta tomorrow. And, I hope you get some concrete progress soon, and I hope you stay the course until you've got that union throughout Atlanta of all the fast food workers, and they've got a contract with $15 an hour as the entry wage. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, Zita, I'll let you go back to your family now. You take care. Thanks for taking the time. All right, so we'll take a quick break, and then we're going to talk to Chris Tilley, who's an economist at UCLA in California.
This is why we fight, why we violate. This is why we fight.
Finally, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, Palm, on demand, and on the go. Get your class more to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Having been raised in a small business family and now running my own small business, I always find it heartwarming to see hardworking, enterprising folks get ahead. So I was really touched when I read that even in these hard times, one extended family with three generations active in their enterprise is hanging in there and doing well. Chrissy, Jim, Alice, Robbie, Ann, and Nancy are their names, and with good luck and old-fashioned pluck, they've managed to build a family nest egg that totals right at $103 billion. Yes, six people, 100 plus billion bucks. That means that these six hold more wealth than the entire bottom 40% of American families, a stash of riches greater than the combined wealth of some 49 million of their fellow Americans. How touching is that? The good luck that each of them had is that they were either born into or married into the Walton family, which makes them heirs to the Walmart fortune. That's where old-fashioned pluck comes in, for the world's biggest retailer plucks its profits from the threadbare pockets of low-wage American workers and impoverished sweatshop workers around the world. Four of the Walton heirs rank as the 6th, 9th, 10th, and 11th richest people in our country, possessing a combined net worth of $95 billion. But bear in mind that one's net worth has no relationship to worthiness. These people did nothing to earn their wealth. They just inherited it. And as Walmart plucks more from workers, the heirs grow luckier. In recent years, while the wealth of the typical family plummeted by 39%, the Waltons saw their wealth grow by 22% without having to lift a finger. This is Jim Hightower saying, how odd that the one percenters consider themselves our nation's makers and consider workaday people to be takers. With the Waltons, it's the exact opposite.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
That's Ellie May the Beagle again. Just lonely at home because I wasn't allowed to bring her into the show. Just trying to make Rick Bloomingdale feel a little guilty. Chris Tilley.
Yep.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us tonight.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Hey, Chris Tilley is a professor of urban planning and the director of the UCLA Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Chris also, you know, went to graduate school at the same time I did at MIT, eons ago, in a previous millennium. Just one more personal note. Did Ellis Wazetta end up contacting you recently or not?
Geez, not that I recall.
All right. So for the listening audience, Ellis Wazetta was an intern of the Keystone Research Centers this summer and actually the son of a Ph.D. from Cornell who knows your work, Chris, a guy, Dave Wazetta. So I just was – I know they were out visiting the campus of UCLA because Chris's program is one of the best programs in the country, and so they were, I think, going to try to track you down, but you may have been out of town.
I was out of town a couple of weeks ago. That may have been when they tried to reach me.
Okay. No worries. So, I want to talk about service workers. We've actually had the privilege of talking to a fast food worker who's going on strike tomorrow in Atlanta. We talked to a worker and a community group representative for a big healthcare organizing effort in Pittsburgh at a giant healthcare network, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. So, I mean, a big part of the theme of this show has been around, new efforts, what seems like an incipient movement for economic justice. So I want to get your take on that. And just to start by asking you the basic question, how can low-end service workers win a decent living?
Well, I mean, it really takes two kinds of changes. One is the kind of organizing that we're seeing. But I think in most cases, there's also been a need to change the ground rules in some way. And if you look around the world at wealthier countries where you don't have the same kind of proliferation of low-wage work, you've got some like France where the minimum wage is much higher, and that just lifts the bottom. And there, you know, it's just against the law to have a lot of low-wage workers. There's other countries like in Scandinavia where the structure is much more conducive to unionization. It's much more possible for workers to choose a union. Here, the playing field for unions is pretty unlevel. So I think as long as we've got our current ground rules, it's going to be hard, but I think the kind of organizing that's going on now certainly is pushing in the right direction and certainly going to help.
And again, I think one of the organizing efforts that's kind of informed some of the newer organizing within service industries in a particular metro area or region is something called Justice for Janitors, which partly gained its reputation through efforts in Los Angeles. And so, again, I don't know, I can't recall actually whether you feel like you were part of a team of people who did a bunch of research on the L.A. Justice for Janitors. Did I invent that?
I've done some research on it. I'm not one of the main people out there who's looked at it, but in some ways, Justice for Janitors is one leading example of a variety of campaigns. Hotel Workers Rising is another. There's been a bunch of campaigns with low-wage workers where there's been a number of factors that have been brought into play. The one that's most visible to the general public is they're often very public actions, sort of naming and shaming companies, disrupting company activities, or sometimes just sitting down and blocking traffic. There's large-scale worker mobilization. There's typically a lot of effort goes into crafting a very clear and a message that's as appealing as possible, you know, justice or a living wage, that kind of thing. And then behind the scenes, there's a lot of strategic research that goes into, you know, who do you target first? What are the leverage points? How can you get some of these players to move? So Justice for Janitors was a Service Employees International Union project that was attempting to sort of revitalize unionization of janitors, which had been broken down by processes of subcontracting and just sort of downgrading of the job over decades. And Justice for Janitors was quite successful in one city after another, sort of bringing a bunch of these factors to bear and quite successfully bringing wages back up, building worker voice back up, and so on.
Right. And so just to help the audience understand, so the end result where it's worked, whether it's in a downtown area, office buildings, or in a broader region, is, right, you end up with wage standards that apply across really a whole geographical area. And so you can get, like, wages from something like $7 an hour up to $13, $14, $15 an hour. Is that the basic formula?
Yeah. So typically you get an agreement from different building owners that you'll essentially be prepared to recognize the union and pay a certain wage as long as X percent of other building owners will do it. And then when you've got that number of building owners, then essentially you can go to the contractors and say, look, the building owners are ready to do it. We're going to target you unless you essentially are willing to hold a free and fair union election.
Right.
And so it's basically setting a single regional standard and preventing a whipsawing situation where every contractor is trying to undercut the other contractor by busting the union and driving down wages.
So, and part of the structural feature of the industry and the labor market that these efforts take advantage of is that you can, in fact, because competition is only within the geographical area, you can take wages and benefits out of competition. It's not easy, and again, as Chris said earlier, it's not you can't really use the U.S. law that's supposed to facilitate union organizing to use these to support these approaches, because that effort really takes place one contractor or one building owner at a time, and so it's basically impossible. It's like molasses or something like that. But again, a bunch of these campaigns have in fact shown that you can, in a service industry, in a geographical area, change the wage and benefit standards and then transform poverty wage jobs into, you know, lower middle income jobs, something like that.
Yeah, and some opportunities for upward mobility. In some cases, there's also help for the next generation for kids to get scholarships and various kinds of assistance with school and so on. So it's really trying to create not just a decent basic standard of living, but some pathways to upward mobility.
So, I mean, do you think, you know, again, one line I used about myself, it's a tick off. There's a line about economists that, you know, economists have predicted 7 of the last 3 recessions. And so the line I, you know, used in a blog recently about myself is that I predicted 3 of the last 0 new deals for a new economy. So I mean, the question is, do you feel like we're, with the fast food worker protests, you know, with more visibility to, some of the Walmart activities, or, for example, Black Friday protests at Walmart last Friday after Thanksgiving, with some of the other service sector organizing efforts, are we approaching a watershed or not, or who knows? What's your perspective in terms of whether at least, you know, there's some reason for optimism?
Well, as you just said, it's very tricky to predict watersheds. And, you know, there's a famous quote from president of the American Economic Association, 1934, saying, you know, basically we can give up on unions as a factor in the American workplace for the foreseeable future. And in the next several years, there was the biggest strike wave this country has ever seen and the biggest push for unionization this country has ever seen.
Right.
So I'm reluctant to make any kind of confident predictions. I feel like experimentation is good, and that the kind of one way to describe what's going on now with the fast food strikes and the Walmart strikers and so on is it's various experiments with minority unionism, where you don't worry so much about we want to win a majority election and go through the very difficult channels of the existing laws. It's just saying we're going to mobilize people who identify with the union and are willing to act with the union. We're going to start winning things. And there's been some success with that. Compared to the alternative, which has really been a flop for decades, it's good. But to say this is going to revolutionize the process of unionization and this is going to open the floodgates, I'm very reluctant to make that prediction.
Right. I don't know whether you had a chance to watch President Obama's speech today on the 50th anniversary of the Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech?
I'm afraid I did not. A lot of commentators have stressed that it was a march for jobs and freedom, so I hope that President Obama spoke to both.
He certainly did. I mean, I've been beating up on him for, you know, in a civil way, for a couple of hours, because I just, he said some of the right things. Certainly said the right things about the importance of social movements without quite using that phrase, and paying, you know, a lot of respect to people who participated in the struggle. And he talked a lot about economic injustice, and that's part of the unfinished business. What was missing was, at least for me, was any kind of awareness. I mean, it's like he put all the responsibility on the grassroots people. It's like, well, Martin Luther King was also part of what happened. Right, and sort of like there's something called mobilization or leadership, and so what I was explicitly looking for was some kind of acknowledgement that maybe in passing that you know, there are these incipient movements for economic justice and, you know, an oblique pat on the back, right? You know, I mean, again, there is a debate among historians about whether or not President Roosevelt actually said the president wants you to join a union in the 1930s. So, I mean, I guess it would have been unrealistic to expect Obama to say that. But anyway, I just seemed to me he stopped at the general and said the right general things. But to me, it was just a gaping omission to not acknowledge that. You know, I don't know where we are in terms of an analog with the civil rights movement, whether we're in 1953 or 1957, or, right? But so that was my complaint.
I think to me there's some pretty basic statements you can make about the role of movements and the right to organize that to have democracy. You can't just have a bunch of individuals sort of making up their minds. The reality is that these kinds of big and hard to make social changes always come from collective action.
Right.
That's part of democracy. You don't have democracy without social movement.
Right.
And you certainly don't have economic justice or any kind of voice in the workplace unless there's organizations in the workplace, organizations of workers.
Right.
So to me, unions, as well as community groups and social movements, are an integral part of democracy. So if you believe in democracy, you kind of have to say this is part of the deal to me.
Right. Right. No, that's right. But so I'm, you know, again, I'm partly voicing these concerns. There's always tomorrow. Maybe you can do better on the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. Which is coming up in November.
Well, I mean, on the other hand, I think that conservatives have shown some awareness of this, so that there's been a lot of nurturing of the Tea Party and saying, see, it's great, it's a grassroots movement.
Right.
You know, this is we're responsive to the will of the people.
Right.
And so
right.
I don't understand why Obama doesn't do that a little more.
Especially since he's a former organizer. The good news is, at least from my point of view, is despite fairly dismal economic trends. I mean, we just published today our annual state of work in Pennsylvania, which, if anything, is slightly worse for the last couple of years than the U.S. trends. But again, the silver lining for me is there is at least, you know, more creative organizing going on. And I think also a bunch of these campaigns, I mean, the Pittsburgh one and UPMC is an example that we talked about earlier, but where unions are just doing a much better job of explaining to the community why a union would be a good thing, not only for the members, but for the broader, you know, community. So, Chris, anything else you'd like to say before I let you go?
Well, the one thing I would point to that we haven't talked about that's an important factor, and this is something that Rich Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, has increasingly recognized, is there is this new kind of organization that's been called worker centers, which is particularly happening with groups of immigrant workers, a lot of them in here in L.A., but you also find them in most of the big cities. Certainly in Philadelphia and elsewhere,
right?
Where you have, it's not exactly a union, it's not exactly a community organization. It's this combination of organizing and advocacy and education, and there's been a lot of creative innovation by those folks. And so I just wanted to recognize them as another factor that, you know, hasn't built up membership on anything to scale the unions, but again is out there doing important experiments I think unions can learn from and benefit from and build alliances with, and unions are starting to do that.
No, you are right. I mean, Philadelphia has about a three-year-old restaurant opportunity center, which we actually honored at our annual dinner earlier this year. And there's a restaurant opportunity center which is about to get off the ground in Pittsburgh. And
mm-hmm.
No, I think, yeah, so I think you're right. That is an important, another important piece of the picture. And we're not allowed to retire until we fix this problem, Chris. I just thought I'd let you know that.
could be a long career then.
I guess so. Well, we can't afford to retire anyway, right? Since we don't have a decent pension, so maybe you do. But anyway, all right, Chris. Thanks so much for taking the time. Great to talk to you, and I hope to see you soon.
Okay, it was a pleasure, Steve.
All right, take care. We are going to take a break. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. This is Steve Herzenberg from the Keystone Research Center.
Living in the cold ash yard, the 97 families, put off 97 farms. I think about my grandpa, my neighbors and my name. It's a nice feel like that.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Herzenberg, here with Luke Vargas, who's a UN correspondent. Luke, thanks for being with us.
Hey, it's great to speak to you.
Let's talk a little bit about Syria, which has been one of the topics very much in the news recently. Catch us up on what's going on there.
Well, the morning began in London a few hours before it did here in New York. I report from the United Nations, and that's where I was beginning pretty early this morning. The United Kingdom introduced a resolution hoping to get some legal authority, essentially, for a coalition involving the United States, involving France, and involving a number of other Middle Eastern allies of the U.S. to be able to use force in Syria. It seemed over the past few days that the U.S. is going to act on this a little bit regardless of what the inevitable opinion of the Security Council is. As you know, the Russian veto power is utilized very frequently, and to a certain extent it's become an institutionalized impasse at the United States, at the United Nations, rather.
Right.
And this morning, the English lawmakers tried to move through a draft resolution, and before long, the wind just totally came out from the sails on that one. The P5 actually met. This is the Security Council permanent members, which involve China and Russia, as well as the UK, the US, and France. And they met privately, not calling on the whole council. They couldn't even agree to anything. And essentially the bill stopped there without ever reaching the Security Council. It was a complete breakdown of maybe what is the last-ditch attempt to try to get some authorization for a military strike on Syria from the United Nations. And I believe this institution is going to fade out of focus pretty quickly after this.
So does this mean it's more likely that the U.S. will end up taking action on its own?
It's not going to be on its own. The United Kingdom introduced today's motion,
right.
and the U.S. was saying, we really support this bill. And I wonder, though, if the U.K. doing this now isn't their turn at the plate. And then come the weekend when the U.N. chemical weapons team is supposed to conclude its work in Damascus, the U.S. might introduce a resolution itself that, when vetoed officially, perhaps by Russia, will be the final, the curtain call, and then some sort of conflict will begin. I don't think this is the very end for the U.N., but it's certainly the end for the English. And there's a lot of disappointment tonight from the conservative government of David Cameron in England that, in addition to being shot down at the United Nations, a bill that was trying to basically a negotiation in Parliament that was supposed to do, give an authorization, a national authorization for intervention, was taken apart when the Labour leader, Ed Miliband, said he was channeling his frustrations about not doing this during the Iraq War, pieced together enough of an opposition to prevent the Prime Minister from authorizing any military action until the UN team concludes its work on the weekend. So on both fronts, on either side of the Atlantic, the United Kingdom not getting it done as far as international authorization or national authorization is concerned on Syria today.
I mean, that for those of us who don't follow the UN closely and know a little bit about its origins,
sure.
and the likes of Eleanor Roosevelt and, the aspirations of the UN, I mean, this is depressing. I mean, people like to lampoon the UN and it's the difficulty it has acting, but this is bad news in terms of Syria in the short run. But if this dooms the UN in some more fundamental way, that seems serious.
Yeah, we can certainly point our fingers at the UN here, and I think to a certain extent, almost every party involved would like to see them, be able to come to more agreements. At the same time, they are playing a role here. The U.S. military can put together plans for an attack pretty quickly, especially when we're working in concert, as was the case in the Jordan meetings with Chief Martin Dempsey over the weekend, with 10 nations probably sharing military plans. Just because the armed forces can mobilize quickly doesn't mean the go-ahead needs to be given right away. And to some extent, though it's taken a beating in public relations, the U.N. is actually slowing down military strikes here. The fact that their teams are on the ground physically prevents airstrikes on the country, and it will give the world at least 4 more days to think over how we feel about this. And in the long run, there may be some logistical setbacks as far as the Assad government taking soldiers out of certain areas or removing chemical weapons and storing them away. I don't know, it really doesn't seem like it could be that terrible that we wait 4 more days to push the button on these cruise missiles. And that's sort of the role the UN is playing here.
To slow it down.
Gives everyone time to think. There were polls out last week saying somewhere north of 85% of the United States public was not in favor of a military strike.
Right.
If we give it 4 more days, if the U.S. can show more of the footage that purports to impugn the Assad government in this, shows them to be responsible for the attack last week, rather. I think public opinion might change, and it's good to have as many people on board if you are going to do an operation like this.
Can I switch topics on you?
Please.
To the news about the military court sentencing Major Nidal Hassan for the shooting rampage at Fort Hood in 2009.
Correct.
What happened there?
Well, this has been a very interesting trial. This is a gentleman, Hassan, was a soldier himself, and there's been a lot of shakeups in this trial with his counsel basically being relieved of its duties, his court-appointed counsel, on 2 occasions by Mr. Hassan himself, saying that he wanted to be his own lawyer, Then people stepped in and said he's trying to get the death penalty for himself. He is so convinced of the righteousness of his massacre at Fort Hood that he wants to find a way to get executed. You know, that dynamic, that saga has come to an end with the court finding him guilty on pretty much every count, and he will be put to death. This would be the first soldier in 50 years to suffer that fate. And it will be a few years before anything comes about. There's a lengthy appeals process in trials like this. But as of today, Nandal Hassan will face the death penalty.
There was other news with regard to the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, a short delay in the final approval date for insurance plans to be sold on the I think it's the federal exchanges.
That's correct. We have the exchanges, the online exchanges for health care supposed to go online on October the 1st. There was already some indication that might be pushed back. Before you could even launch the website, you'd have to have approved plans. That was supposed to happen, basically on September 1st. Now it's being pushed back from another pushback date of between the 5th and the 9th. We're now looking at mid-September, so you've heard of different parties involved in this complaining about delays on all ends. Here we have a delay coming from the Department of Health and Human Services, probably acknowledging the fact that the insurance companies that may want to be on this exchange or may not want to be on this exchange, they've waited until the 11th hour, many of them, to decide what their policy wants to be on this. It's forced the government here to cave a little bit again and delay once more.
Although, again, in the grand scheme, it seems like a pretty modest delay.
It should be. It is very minor. If it is to be the middle of September compared to the 9th, it's not terrible. We're certainly not looking at a rapid crumbling of this legislation, at least today, just a minor setback.
And the last topic, the Postal Service has been in the news again today, and actually some of my friends in this part of central Pennsylvania, a family that we do a lot of things with socially, actually has a number of different people who deliver the mail, so I keep watching the Postal Service with some anxiety on their behalf. Apparently there's concern among some private businesses about a possible rate increase?
That's correct. This would be a broad rate increase across the board. And it comes at a time, you know, the Postal Service, as you probably well know, has been under fire for a number of years now. And defenders of the Postal Service are saying here that actually in the past year they've cut a lot of the red ink at the agency. They have unveiled new product lines, but one of them is the ability for companies not even to need to address individual envelopes. You just drop off a stack of 10,000, pizza flyers for pizza takeout at the Postal Service, and they just drop one off at each of their stops. It's services like that that have helped change the books a little bit at the Postal Service, and advocates saying give them more time before you maybe alienate some of that new business by reacting so quickly. Let things balance out.
Do you have a prediction on that?
I don't. I haven't seen the exact figures that they're proposing on the rate here, and I don't know too. I certainly have received a lot more mail of the sort I was just describing in the past year or so as this program came in. Living near a metropolitan area, there are tons of things that come across via this method. If it makes the Postal Service more profitable in the long run, then I'd like to see them, you know, continue implementing that and maybe stave off rate increases. But I don't have a finger in the wind on this one.
Luke, thanks for your time tonight. This is Luke Vargas from the Talk Radio News Service. He told me before we went on air that he's actually at the U.S. Open, the tennis tournament in Queens. We'll send you back to your tennis now, Luke.
Thank you very much. It was great speaking to you. Have a good night.
You too. Bye. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We'll be back. I'm your guest host, Steve Hertzenberg.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Having been raised in a small business family and now running my own small business,
I always find it heartwarming to see hard-working, enterprising folks get ahead. So I was really touched when I read that even in these hard times, one extended family with three generations active in their enterprise is hanging in there and doing well. Chrissy, Jim, Alice, Robbie, Ann, and Nancy are their names, and with good luck and old-fashioned pluck, they've managed to build a family nest egg that totals right at $103 billion. Yes, six people, 100 plus billion bucks. That means that these six hold more wealth than the entire bottom 40% of American families, a stash of riches greater than the combined wealth of some 49 million of their fellow Americans. How touching is that? The good luck that each of them had is that they were either born into or married into the Walton family, which makes them heirs to the Walmart fortune. That's where old-fashioned pluck comes in, for the world's biggest retailer plucks its profits from the threadbare pockets of low-wage American workers and impoverished sweatshop workers around the world. Four of the Walton heirs rank as the 6th, 9th, 10th, and 11th richest people in our country, possessing a combined net worth of $95 billion. But bear in mind that one's net worth has no relationship to worthiness. These people did nothing to earn their wealth. They just inherited it. And as Walmart plucks more from workers, the heirs grow luckier. In recent years, while the wealth of the typical family plummeted by 39%, the Waltons saw their wealth grow by 22% without having to lift a finger. This is Jim Hightower saying, how odd that the one percenters consider themselves our nation's makers and consider workaday people to be takers. With the Waltons, it's the exact opposite.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm your guest host, Steve Herzenberg, sitting in for Rick. I'm from the Keystone Research Center, www.keystoneresearch.org. We're now going to play the last couple very short snippets from what Obama did say in his speech on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And then I'm actually going to tell you what I wish he'd said. So here we go.
But the good news is, just as was true in 1963, we now have a choice. We can continue down our current path in which the gears of this great democracy grind to a halt and our children accept a life of lower expectations, where politics is a zero-sum game, where few do very well while struggling families of every race fight over a shrinking economic pie. That's one path. Or we can have the courage to change. The March on Washington teaches us that we are not trapped by the mistakes of history, that we are masters of our fate. But the good news is, just as was true in 1963, we know. And that's the lesson of our past. That's the promise of tomorrow. That in the face of impossible odds, people who love their country can change it.
So again, he ends by recognizing the importance of social movements, the March on Washington, and connects it clearly to the challenge of fixing our polarized economy. So it's like, okay, we've taken the horse to water. So, and it's tantalizingly close to recognizing the importance of movements for economic justice now. But again, what's missing is any recognition that there is worker mobilization going on right now. So here's what I would have had Obama say, and I wrote this quickly this morning before his actual speech, and it's not as elegant as what he writes, but it gives the worker organizing that's taking place now a more explicit endorsement. So this is what I would have had him say. Today again, a growing chorus of organizers and workers are challenging the stark inequality that has emerged in America over the past third of a century. Fast food workers in over 50 cities will rally tomorrow for a $15 per hour wage. Healthcare workers in Pittsburgh are rallying to lift entry-level wages above $15 per hour and to transform area wage standards so that all who work hard and play by the rules can again support their families. Workers at giant retailers seek a similar outcome, with entry-level service positions going from poverty wage jobs to family-supporting jobs in the blink of an eye. If we simply honor workers' basic freedoms, freedom to associate, freedom to organize, freedom to join a union, workers in our major service industries would flock to area-wide locals and undo the inequalities that plague our society. So I say to you on this anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, I say to fast food workers and retail chain workers, to healthcare workers and restaurant workers, to all American workers who want a fair deal for their family, this president wants you to join a union. This one simple step, real protection of workers' right to join a union, could produce the economic justice that this country so desperately needs. Only with this simple step can we complete Martin Luther King's dream. With this step, we can have liberty and justice for all. Now, again, I never thought there was a snowball's chance in heck that Obama would say anything really like that. But I did hope that he would say something more oblique. And again, we all know that Chris Tilley, the professor from UCLA, sort of talked about this a little. We got to change the rules of the game. We have to change American law. But we're not changing American law, whether it's to do with the minimum wage and lifting it to $12 and indexing to inflation plus productivity growth, or we're not going to change American law with regard to unions and make it easier to form unions, not just at one workplace, but make it possible to have union elections of all fast food workers in a metro area, of all healthcare workers in a metro area. The current lineup, any conceivable lineup for the next several Congresses, that's unimaginable. But that's not the task that, at least I was hoping Obama would rise to today. The task is to help the work that has to happen before we can change the rules, to help the worker mobilization and organizing that's on the verge of potentially taking off and reaching a whole new level. Because it's after that organizing, without a change in the rules, it's after that organizing that succeeded in a certain number of industries, in a certain number of places, then everybody could say, you know what, that's how we get the middle class back. We lift all those jobs up into the middle class. Together, we give people training and career ladders. We revitalize the American dream that way. Once people are clear on how attainable that is, then maybe we can get the changes in politics and laws that will take that kind of effort to scale. So missed opportunity today. Obama's still got 2 years and about 4 months. So hopefully he'll do better on the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. It's never too late to tell workers.